You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 22nd of March 2014 on Monocle 24.
Artful Fashion Publishing, an art magazine that's sculpting a new course and a choice selection of magazines to review. We're stacked up and ready to flick through them here on Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. I'm Tom Edwards, standing in for Tyler Brulé on The Stack this week, and we'll be joined by a friend of the programme, an editor who now sits at the very top of her game in the world of magazines for women. We'll also be heading to New York City, where one stylish title is realising its artistic ambitions.
It's a geographical attempt at editing, in the sense that what influences are happening in New York right now are obviously going to be a little bit different than Mexico, they're going to be different in Spain. We kind of want to tap into that.
All that and plenty more besides on this 82nd edition of The Stack, right here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. Much to get through today, but first, let's meet our guest. If one magazine has changed the face of fashion editorial of late, then The Gentlewoman it must be. Since being launched by the men behind pioneering titles Butt and Fantastic Man in 2008, Penny Martin has been at the helm, bringing a refined, if informal, attitude to high fashion. And some cover girls that have had everyone talking, I think Angela Lansbury, Beyonce, and most recently, of course, Vivienne Westwood. Penny, welcome back to The Stack. Very good to have you with us. Let's talk a little bit about your cover girls on The Gentlewoman, because it's certainly one of the most sort of arresting presences on the newsstand. What's the process? I'm sure you've sort of talked about this before, by which you select your cover girls. Is it quite complex, or do you just more instinctively? Almost?
It is. You know, we only have 2 a year. Obviously, we're a biannual magazine, and we don't do multiple covers. So there's a lot of pressure on it, because that person carries your message for 6 months and kind of defines what you're trying to do. And there's a lot of discussions about who it should be. You know, it's difficult to secure a cover. If you're looking for a celebrity cover, there's a whole, you know, many, many layers of kind of politics and difficult processes to be involved. And then there's a lot of questions about whether we should be promoting celebrities. So, you know, for a cover story, you always want somebody with a big story. And that tends to be a woman that's after her 30s and 40s. You know, she's had the divorce, her career's imploded, she's come back. You know, there's a lot to write about. And that's the kind of rich, definitive story we're interested in. But you don't want to become solely about older women. So there's got to be a balance. And that means that if you want a younger subject, there's a lot of pressure on them in terms of the story. So yeah, it really occupies my mind for maybe 4 months before the magazine is made. And, you know, people think of biannual magazine, what are you doing in between? But, you know, God, I'm fretting, you know, the whole time, you know, and arguing and kind of pleading, basically. That's my job.
And then when you sort of settle on someone like Vivienne Westwood, I mean, how does that work in terms of when you're actually looking at the sort of image you want? What kind of essence then are you capturing? Or is it rather almost easier with someone like Vivienne Westwood, where, you know, there is such a story, you know, people are kind of aware of some of that background?
We were very lucky to, in terms of the story, we're very lucky to be working with Deborah Orr, who's just an excellent journalist and also has a very interesting kind of cultural life herself. So, you know, they had very interesting discussions. And I think also because she has a very famous husband, she also understood that it was a partnership between her and her husband, Vivienne, and her husband, Andreas. So that made the story very interesting. In terms of the image, our images are always the result of very sophisticated and long-standing relationships with photographers. You'll notice that our pool for cover stories, our cover images, actually isn't very wide. And that tends to be because we make a lot of demands of what we want. And I think with somebody like Vivienne Westwood, you know, she's a household icon. Everybody knows what she looks like. So it was important for us to present her in the way that said that it was a gentlewoman image, just as we did, say, with Beyonce, as you say, and Adele before her, and Angela and all the other ones. And, you know, for me, she looks heroic and full of, with a sense of humour, and really powerful and intelligent. And I think those things are really important, as well as extremely beautiful. You know, she's 72 and she looks fantastic. And when I pass newsstands and notice that the people that run the newsstands have repositioned to sort of stick her on the front as if she's kind of framed on the wall, it's really exciting. You don't stop being proud for the full 6 months that it's out.
That must be a great sort of feeling. I wonder about the sort of general reaction, because obviously on The Stack we generally ask people, are many visitors, you know, to select a few titles, maybe to pick through with us, name us some of their favourites. Yeah. We almost have to have a bit of a ban on Gentlewoman, because everyone suggested. I mean, that
so there's nothing left to say about that magazine.
But that must, I mean, it must fill you with a great deal of sort of pride and excitement that it engages with people in that way. I just wondered, in terms of your readership, as you sort of evolved and you have a better sort of instinct, better understanding of what your readership is, do you have a Gentlewoman reader in mind? Does it boil down into an actual sort of person, a composite, or do you still try and sort of cater across a very broad range of perspectives?
Well, I'm repeating things maybe that I've said on this show before, but I think they're also true in that you're making magazines for yourself first and foremost, because then you know you can trust a decision. And you're not kind of, you know, I remember sharing a flat with somebody that worked in Oasis when I was at a postgraduate. She was saying, our core customer is Emma and she's 22. You know, we don't have a kind of a fictionalised woman, because the women inside the magazine, we do anything but fictionalise them. Through kind of aping what I saw working so well at Monocle, where you have events and there's clearly some readers present, we started to do readers events, and then you realise they're a lot younger and they're a lot older than you thought. But we structure them so that we can actually have a conversation. We most recently did one in an independent bookshop in Paris, OFR, and people stand in line. Yes, to get their magazine wrapped by the editor, but actually they want to tell you, you know, there's this amazing horse breeder and she's amazing, or they're from the city. And I think you start to notice that, you know, where they actually come from.
So is it a sort of a reciprocal relationship then? Do you really take things from your readers into your, you know, editorial processes? Or is it something where you obviously want to hear their feedback, their responses, their reactions, but it's not a direct sort of relationship? It doesn't feed straight into the kind of editorial?
Well, you know, I used to edit a website in the kind of 2001 to 2008. And of course, the whole language of editorial online at that stage was all about the two-way relationship, etc. You know, and you built all these message boards so people could have a conversation. Actually, in the end, they became a kind of a conversation in the ether. You know, they weren't very sincere, maybe. So I don't want to kind of over... emphasize, you know, that I listen to everything that everybody tells me and you see on the pages.
You never want to do that.
But I do pay quite a lot of attention to it. And, you know, frankly, it's important that, you know, I think it's important that it does feel like a UK-based magazine and that there's always strong UK content in there. I remember Gert, who edits Fantastic Man, telling me that was the thing he loved about Details magazine, was he felt he was seeing a snapshot of New York. And we've, you know, as much as we want to represent an international woman, I think it's important that you know which perspective it's coming from. This is the UK team's perspective on Mexico in this issue where we did Bertha Gonzalez, for instance. So, yes, you bear it in mind, but you've got to be really self-conscious about the filter.
Talk a little bit about the balance on Gentlewoman. Has that shifted in terms of where your emphasis are, how much, you know, where the balance is in terms of, you know, the volume, the amount of advertising you use? Is it a balance you're happy with? Does that something that changes over time?
I think we're something like, are we 25% or something? I mean, you can see some monthly women's magazines that are almost at 60, and you really feel that reflected in the pages. No, I'm, you know, when people say to you, oh, you know, I love that independent magazine because there's hardly any advertising in it, you know, I do understand what people are saying, but you need a healthy relationship with the industry in order to have the best access and the best quality perspective on fashion. And we're not embarrassed about loving fashion. I think a lot of modern women do. And it's about how you deal with those relationships. And, you know, I think in many biannuals, you can see the kind of ad on one page and the ad with the interview with the designer on the next page. I don't think that that's the kind of media that we are, because we're so interview based and it's not really about the industry as such. But yeah, we've got a very healthy advertising component, and thank goodness we do. It allows us to thrive and commission ever more ambitious writers and photographers to work with us. And, you know, we're run by two extremely clever and canny Dutch men, and, you know, it's not a kind of context of great opulence, but you know, we make careful decisions, and I think that it's a respected environment to appear in. So yeah, we're very lucky, but, you know, there's not five pages of credits for every ad in our magazine, and the people that support us understand what the offer is, that it's very good, well-chosen editorial, but it's not like kind of 8-page specials. We don't have the room to do that in a magazine twice a year.
Let's talk a bit about that editorial process then, because particularly in terms of the sort of photography, like I love this pockets piece that you had in
that's
this
very popular, yes.
In this section. Tell me about sort of the anatomy of the process by which you settle on these kind of ideas. Where does that come from? Is it collaborative? Does someone have that sort of moment of inspiration? Is it driven by what you know a particular contributing photographer can do? How does the process work?
A bit of a few of those things. Well, you mentioned pockets. We don't have a grid, so it's not like there's a format. So, like, which detail is on page 36 this time? But I think that people expect from us a very sort of precise and almost pedantic, maybe neurotic, you might say, detailed sartorial portfolio on dress. So I think that we're about clothes as much as we're about fashion. So something like pockets, yeah, I think I can remember the discussion about that in the editorial meeting. There was like, oh, are they all just going to look like slits? And but then, of course, you mentioned which photographer is appropriate for that. We work with Maurice Shelton's and Lisbeth Abaness, and they are just the best, pardon on, that kind of forensic, but humorous and candid still life. So we have a really fantastic relationship with them. And we give them an idea that sounds as flat as pockets and it comes back, you know, a beauty. And in a way that is a bit like that kind of, what's that quote about Alexei Brodovich just sending people off and saying, surprise me. But that's absolutely what happens with them, that you never know what you're getting back from them.
In terms of great photography, do you feel that the magazine, the piece of paper, it still has an inevitable edge, doesn't it, over its digital counterpart when it comes to capturing something different about photography, bringing it to life in a different way? Or are you slightly more sanguine about it? Do you think actually, you know, the digital, the printed page, they can complement each other, and you know, print doesn't necessarily enjoy that sort of primacy when it comes to great photography?
Well, when somebody would say, what advantage does the printed page have, you know, versus digital in the whole of fashion media, maybe that wouldn't be the first thing I would say, because I think some fashion photography can look wonderful on a screen as if it's a backlit transparency in a gallery. You know, many kinds of especially constructed sort of late 90s, early 2000s art photography looks wonderful in that way. But as you say, the kind of physical qualities and I think it's not really, our photography is about bearing witness in a way, isn't it? And it's about a kind of journalistic take. And we're not really about fetish in that sense. And we're not really about fantasy. But I think that actually what our magazine is about time. And people say that it feels like something you return to over a period of time. You know, for good reason, there's a lot to read and it's almost a book. But I also think it's that thing about sitting back in your seat and having space rather than hunching over your keyboard and demanding what you want to find out. It's just a very different process. So I think that our photography is commissioned with that in mind. It's for a different thing. I don't express that very eloquently.
I think that was pretty eloquently done. Those are the insights of Penny Martin. We'll be hearing more from her as we continue with The Stack a little later. Up next, though, on the programme, we're going to be heading over to New York City.
Style meets substance in the April outing of Monocle. At the heart of the issue is our handsome spring style supplement that looks at the businesses behind looking good, from the retail developers to the watch companies on the up. We then guide you to some new fashion capitals and also reveal lots of rather nice things to buy. In addition, there is our inaugural Top 25 Retail Awards that names everything from the best supermarket to the ultimate corner store. You'll also discover lots more between the covers.
In the design section, we meet the new heroes of social housing, pay a visit to Stockholm Furniture Fair, and showcase one of Bogota's most iconic residential developments, a red brick three-towered estate built in 1970.
In the edit section, we bring you our usual roundup of new hotels and eateries from around the world, including a quaint bed and breakfast in the outskirts of Beirut and a star dish from a Scandinavian-influenced restaurant in Portland. In our specialist pages, we visit Baccarat, the crystal makers that are still going strong after 250 years. And don't miss our exclusive interview with news anchor Lee Lin Chin, who shared a meal with us in Sydney.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up.
Hey And now to New York, where art magazine Tunica was founded in 2012 by Jose Garcia to act as a portable gallery. Published twice a year, Garcia and his team collaborate on every issue with a new director each time, leaving the design, themes and content changing, rather like the walls of a gallery space. Megan Billings from Monocle's New York Bureau joined editor Ben McKernan for a coffee in Brooklyn to chat about the content and get details of the magazine's upcoming bricks and mortar space.
Tunica was kind of born out of, I guess, the need to like publish a kind of art that wasn't really, we felt like wasn't really shown on like most contemporary art magazines. Initially, we thought we'd have like more particular teams, like a metropolitan team, but we kind of wanted to make it broader again. So when we edit the magazine, we always, like, we have like a very broad subject matter. We have guest editors for each magazine. So our last magazine was Fulcher Studios, and this one is going to be Lynn Studios. What we try to do is to create something that is something new and fresh every time. That's the idea about having a different directors as well, as they create like a gallery. Like what we imagine Tunica to be is like a gallery, a running gallery that's different at every magazine. The problem with having one gallery is that you're always confined to like a space, that kind of environment. When Tunica can change, like it's completely molding. For sure, we'll have a completely different magazine next issue, but we'll make sure it'll look like it'll stand out and people will, you know, will love it. We'll have the great, like, with great art content, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so you mentioned to me before that you don't really have one particular geographical focus. Tunica is really broad, so you're working with people from all over the world.
It's like, it's a geographical attempt at editing in the sense that what influences are happening in New York right now are obviously going to be a little bit different than Mexico, they're going to be different than Spain. We kind of want to tap into that. That's kind of like the almost a concept for each magazine, is it like a, not that it's like geographical, but it's like that sense of what the city, what that city is about, what's going on at the moment, what people are influenced by. There's a lot of stuff that's very similar, but like globalization still means that these cities have their own individual look at art and content, and especially the way galleries, especially, like, you know, you have Mexico, you definitely be showing a lot more Mexican art, and that's kind of what we're interested in, is to pursue that, the difference in that.
So you publish two times per year, and in the past, I know your first issue was Metropolis, and then there was an Asian-focused edition. They're all really different. Now you're saying you have a bit of a geographical focus to it, but in terms of readership, how do your readers know what to expect? What can they anticipate to be consistent in each issue?
The focus is like, it's very broad on art content, and we try not to be too specific, because like ideas don't really work, like when people, and especially in the art world, ideas don't really like move straight forward, they move in all different angles, and to capture one theme is very hard, because artists are like notoriously known not to be, you know, if we ask them to make like art for a special team, then they might take months, or we might never hear from again, or a lot of like designers might work like that, but like a lot of artists, like to tell them to work from a team, like, I might stunt the creative process a little bit. So what we try to achieve is like a really open canvas for the artist. And when we approach them, we trust their creative instinct as well. That's why we approach them in the first place. So we're going to give them that opportunity to be part of like a gallery, like this new idea, this new concept.
So this is, you said, kind of almost putting a gallery space into a publication. Do you have any plans to ever make that concrete and have a kind of gallery space?
We're opening a gallery in East Village in April. It'll be a Tunica gallery. We're going to try and represent the artists that are from, that are, we publish in our magazine as well, to give them a different platform. We're obviously really passionate about the people that we do represent. So to be able to do that is actually, it's good for us, but it's good for the whole concept of Tunica as well. And to have a concrete base from where we can work.
I think it's really unique that you actually started in print and then are going to have a more concrete gallery after that. It's quite special. Do you anticipate that that's going to be a permanent space?
Yeah, hopefully, definitely.
That was Megan Billings from Monocle's New York Bureau in conversation with Ben McKernan of Tunica magazine. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, still with me, Penny Martin from The Gentlewoman. And Penny, we were talking before about editorial processes, about the relationships between readers and creators of media and between advertisers and media. I wonder, when you browse your rivals or just other magazines on newsstand, what jumps out at you? Are you still sort of driven by cover images? If there's an arresting cover image, is that enough to kind of draw you in? Or do you need more? Do you need a bit more backstory? Do you need to be kind of tantalised by the promise of something else? Do you have a very sort of, is your experience of magazines shaped by that first reaction?
That's a very interesting question, because I realised that my consumption of magazines is split into two different activities, but a lot of that must be to do with my job. But I stand at newsstands a lot and I scan who they've got, quite honestly, and look at the way that they've been photographed. So yeah, I look at covers a lot as if it's the digest of what's inside. So I do realise from the way that I look at other magazines what people must do.
Is that work?
Ours.
Is that work or pleasure? Is that because you want to see the great stories? Because you need to feel like you're across the marketplace, or is it a bit of both, perhaps?
Well, it's interesting because it's rare that it's rare that I pick that magazine up and look inside. The magazine I read is the one that I subscribe to. So actually, the two aren't connected. I still read The New Yorker and I still read other long-form magazines. And increasingly, I'm afraid, I read quite a lot of long-form journalism that's been directed to me via Twitter. So a lot of my long-form consumption is digital, but I spend a lot of time at magazine stands looking at pictures, but not participating. Is that a disappointing answer?
No, I think it's very candid. And what about sort of different marketplaces? You mentioned that interesting idea of capturing a UK identity with the magazine, but still talking to, you know, the international reader. It's quite a complex relationship. Do you feel there are parts of the world that sort of do that job better, that give the reader a sense of the local while fitting into the international picture? Are there particular sort of marketplaces that excite you still?
Gosh, that's interesting. I think Sweden, Swedish media feels very strong, and whether or not it's your taste, but, you know, maybe at the Antipodes as well. Is that because I remember when I worked online, that those were the countries that were very outward looking and they were very quickly switched on to online fashion, much before the rest of Europe and North America in a lot of ways. So I wonder if it's that sort of longing, kind of looking across the waters. I don't know. But, you know, I feel that I have a sense. And obviously Japan, but, you know, that's also, you know, as simple as looking at a different language in the type, isn't it?
Absolutely. Well, let's take a look at one of the other titles that you've brought with you onto the programme today. Describe it to our listeners, perhaps. Before you name it, describe its form and its form and function first, so we can capture the essence.
Yeah, well, you might think it's far away from the world of The Gentlewoman. Maybe that's why I'm interested in it. It is a broadsheet-sized music fanzine run by very strongly female group of people that are very switched into other magazines, but it came out of another kind of fanzine called Pix, and it's doing really well and it's growing and it's really ambitious and it's got a really rambunctious, fun, excitable kind of atmosphere to it, and I really look forward to it, and the new issue's just come out.
So this is Beat.
Yeah.
And tell us about this, because it's funny, I seem to always be reading about the tragic demise of, you know, the music journal and how, you know, something we'll never get back to the halcyon days. There are some people who are doing a pretty good job, though.
Indeed, it's sort of fractured away, isn't it? It's not the old, you wouldn't probably look to NME for what you get from Beat. Certainly, but what's interesting this time is they've got Lily Allen on the cover, so they're clearly, I know that their circulation has expanded and they're really obviously looking to make an impact and have people talking about it, you know, otherwise they wouldn't have picked Lily, but they've got amazing photographers working for them. That one's photographed by Angelo Panetta, but they've got a strong, you know, there's not loads and loads of advertising, but it's very well chosen, and Saint Laurent is on the back cover, and they are well known to be supporting a lot of new and young media forms, especially print, which is kind of exciting and interesting and good for them. But yeah, it's growing, and I think they're kind of really hitting North America. I mean, it's a free paper, and I just think it's really well done, and the tone of the you know, Eva, people like Eva Wiseman and Eleanor Morgan and so on are writing for it. So it's all the kind of Guardian girls. And I just like the idea that this imagined community of the people that put it together are kind of like a really fun bunch of girls to go out with. And I think that's what a magazine should feel like.
And it's got a nice kind of, there's sort of almost slightly kind of old school design elements to it. It has that kind of zine quality, but it also has that, I don't know, sort of a mid-80s look. Is it
do you feel
it's kind of harking
70s.
Back to that? Yeah, to the halcyon days of that form of music journalism.
Yeah, without speaking for them, they'd be pretty knowledgeable about their antecedents and, precedents rather. And I'm sure they've looked a lot at kind of NME in the late 70s. That's the way that the type seems to be laid out. And it's, you know, it's got a lot of energy and it's not trying to overcomplicate or over-design itself. Yeah, no, I've got a lot of admiration for them and I'm sort of super behind the magazine. I think they just come across as nice people, you know, and that's what you want to be part of when you read a magazine. It's like, I like them, I'd like to have dinner with them.
We love a bit of a good news story, a good news print story on the Stack,
yeah.
And that's certainly one. I just wondered finally, with that sort of title and that kind of objective, how much of a challenge is it to get something like that right, to get the balance right? Because you're talking to quite a particular audience. As you said, there's issues with, you know, the kind of advertising, the kind of look, the kind of feel, if there's a sort of retro quality. What's the main things that you need to get that balance right? Is it just a very, very clear editorial direction? Is it great sort of wise counsel surrounding you? Is it just a bit of luck, lots of money? Or is it not easy to say there's kind of one key thing that shapes the success of something like that?
It is a very difficult question, but I think you need a good idea and you need good taste.
Simple as that.
Yeah, and good energy about you, you know, kindness and kind of generosity, and it'll come out in the magazine.
Fantastic. There you go. That's the secret to magazine success, brought to you by Penny Martin here on The Stack. Penny, thanks very much for being with us.
You're
on
welcome.
The programme this week. That brings us to the end of edition 82 of The Stack. Special thanks to Penny, of course, to our producer, David Pleasant, and behind the glass here at Midori House to Claire Barn. Any comments, queries or remarks are polite, if you will. Please drop us a note at info@monocle.com and don't forget we'll be back next Saturday at the very same time. You can always listen again at monocle.com via iTunes or SoundCloud. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, that's all from the show. Thanks for listening.